certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about Cable Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feet to Fire campaign and protest on Monday, March 25th at 10 a.m. at the Clackamas County Circuit Courthouse in Oregon City. The Feet to Fire campaign is part of the national campaign started by Protect Our Stolen Treasures Out of Detroit. This peaceful protest calls for justice for those lost to police violence and hate crimes. Again, that's Feet to Fire campaign and protest on Monday, March 25th at 10 a.m. at the Clackamas County Courthouse, 807 Main Street in Oregon City. For more information, can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 9:01 on the fourth Friday, which means One Land, Many Voices is up next. That'll be followed at 10 with all new show here on KBOO. Film at 11. At 10. Reviewing the latest films from the multiplex to the art houses to the Northwest Film Center and streaming films. At 10:30, Sprouts features an interview with Grammy Award-winning native artist Dawn Avery. And at 11, it's Pacific Underground, where Asian and Pacific Islander Americans take the mic into their own hands. Yes. And all of this KBOO programming is possible by the auspices of the members of the KBOO Foundation. To become a member, to renew your flagging membership, to return after allowing your membership to lapse, we promise we won't make any judgments. Go to kboo.fm and click on the button marked donate. And now, as promised, this is One Land with Many Voices.
Good evening, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of the show. We will listen to the powerful words of Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. since we'll be talking about her after this break. So let's listen in to what she said 2 weeks ago at Busboys and Poets Restaurant in Washington, D.C. This is a really must-listen-to words, and we'll be right back.
It almost as if every single time we say something, regardless of what it is we say, that is supposed to be about foreign policy, our engagement, our advocacy about ending oppression, or the freeing of every human life and wanting dignity, we get to be labeled in something, and that ends the discussion because we end up defending that, and nobody ever gets to have the broader debate of what is happening with Palestine. So for me, I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it is okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country. I want to ask, why is it okay for me to talk about the influence of the NRA, of fossil fuel industries, or big pharma, and not talk about a powerful lobbying group that is influencing policy? Right? I want to ask the question of why is it okay for you to push, for you to be put, there are so many people, I mean, most of us are new, but many members of Congress have been there forever. Some of them have been there before we were born. So I know many of them were fighting for people to be freed, for people to live in dignity in South Africa. I know many of them fight for people around the world to have dignity, to have self-determination. So I know that they care about these things. But now that you have two Muslims who are saying, here is a group of people that we want to make sure they have the dignity that you want everybody else to have, we get to be called names and we get to be labeled as hateful? No, we know what hate looks like. We experience it every single day. I have colleagues who talk about death threats. And sometimes there are cities in my state where the gas stations have written on their bathrooms, assassinate Ilhan Omar. I have people driving around my district looking for my home, for my office, causing me harm. I have people every single day on Fox News and everywhere posting that I am a threat to this country. So I know what fear looks like. The masjid I pray in Minnesota, got bombed by two domestic white terrorists. So I know what it feels to be someone who is of faith that is vilified. I know what it means to be of someone who is of ethnicity that is vilified. I know what it feels to be of a race, right? Like I am an immigrant, so I don't have the historical drama that some of my black sisters and brothers have in this country, but I know what it means for people to just see me as a black person and to treat me as less than a human. And so when people say you are bringing hate, I know what their intention is. Their intention is to make sure that our lights are dimmed, that we walk around with our heads bowed, that we lower our face and our voice. But we have news for people. You can call us any kind of name. You can threaten us any kind of way. Rashida and I are not ourselves. Every single day we walk in the halls of Congress, we have people who have never had the opportunity to walk there walking with us. So we're here to say and represent the voices of people who have been silenced for many decades and generations. And we're here to fight for the people of our district who want to make sure that there is actual prosperity. Actual prosperity being guaranteed. Because there is a direct correlation between not having a clean water and starting endless wars. It's all about the profit and who gets benefit of it. There's a correct correlation between corporations that are getting rich and the fact that we have students that are shackled with debt. Yes. There is a direct correlation between the White House and the people who are benefiting from having detention beds that are privatized. Yes. So what people are afraid of is not that there are two Muslims in Congress. What people are afraid of is that there are two Muslims in Congress that have their eyes wide open, that have their feet to the ground, that know what they're talking about, that are fearless, and that understand that they have the same election certificate as everyone else in Congress.
That was Congresswoman Ilhan Omar speaking 2 weeks ago at Busboys and Poets Restaurant in Washington, D.C. Very, very powerful words. And joining us now live from Washington, D.C. is Abid Ayoub. He is the National Legal and Policy Director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC. He works to address issues impacting Arabs and Muslims in the U.S., including discrimination, hate crimes, and profiling. He also works to enhance the community's economic empowerment and access to education. Abid Ayoub also represents the Arab and Muslim community on Capitol Hill, working regularly with members of Congress. Abid, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
We are glad to have you in the show. Would like to get your reaction to this political theater that we have witnessed over the past few months since Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, two Arab American Muslim women elected to Congress, and this unbelievable hegemony against them, whether it's from media outlets, politicians, even members of their own party, Democrats, Republicans, and they are coming up with all kinds of things to discredit them and to fearmonger people from them.
Yes, it's very unfortunate. I mean, this is a proud moment for, you know, the Arab community, the Somali community, and the Muslim community, you know, to have these women elected during these challenging times. And what we're going through is it's really a testament to the fact that women are playing a key role in leading our respective communities forward. And they are our strongest voices. And Ilhan and Rashida have made that very clear. The attacks on them and the recent attacks on Ilhan, they shouldn't surprise us. The other side, the money on the right, and many within the Democratic Party do fear those who want to go beyond the status quo, who want to shake things up and really amplify the voice of those that they represent. And that does strike fear in these people in D.C. who have really kept the status quo and made themselves comfortable and benefit from what's going on around them. So it is disheartening to see the attacks, but we do have to stand up with them. We do have to have their back and defend them and support them in any way we can. And this is only the start, and there's still another year and a half left of their terms before re-election. So we do have to make sure that we are there for them.
That is correct. And, you know, President Trump, even himself, as well as the Republicans and some Democrats, they've been attacking her for speaking about the influence, especially of the Israel lobby in the United States. And we just heard her talk which I say they were very powerful, but there was nothing out of the ordinary. You would think that should be the norm for all people in Congress, for all representatives, to ask and questions who influences politicians, who pays who to say what, to do what. And there's nothing wrong that she has said. She's actually, again, that you would think would be the norm for everybody else in Congress, responsible politician, to question. But this accusation against her makes no sense.
No, you're right. I mean, we have to question who's pulling the strings in Congress. And we are at a point now where these advocacy groups, these lobby groups, are advocating for their self-interest. And it's just like the NRA, and it's just like any other group out there that's got a massive amount of money and a massive amount of influence. And the money correlates with the influence. So what Ahan said is actually accurate, that AIPAC, as we all know, as anybody that's worked on this issue knows, drives policy when it comes to matters related to Israel. And if you look at the history of AIPAC, going back to the 50s and 60s, when they were the Zionist Organization of America, they were forced to break up after the government forced them to register as foreign agents, and then they went through restructuring, and now they're, essentially a nonprofit almost, or an advocacy group where they don't have to report as thoroughly as a foreign agent would. In our opinion at ADC, AIPAC should be a foreign agent, beyond just questioning them. In questioning their influence, we have to look at what their influence is. Who's giving that money? Where is that money coming from? Where is it being implemented? So in what direction does the state of Israel give AIPAC on policy decisions? And how much coordination is there between AIPAC and the state of Israel? So organizations here, advocacy organizations or nonprofits here, can't coordinate with a foreign government. It would be like if ADC took instructions from the state of Lebanon on issues to discuss and positions to take. We don't do that. There's a wall and a barrier. We would never consider doing that. But with AIPAC, it's different. What is the relationship between the state of Israel and AIPAC, and how is Israel using AIPAC to drive policy of the U.S.? In our bottom line, we do believe Ilhan was right. We would take it a step further to say it's time to force, the government should force AIPAC to register as a foreign agent.
You know, Abed, I want to mention something. A friend of mine sent me this. He pointed it out to me that was in the Wall Street Journal, actually, that the Wall Street Journal tweeted about a week or two ago, and I want to quote that tweet by the Wall Street Journal. AIPAC, the pro-Israel lobby, raises more than $100 million a year, which it spends on lobbying politicians for U.S. aid and sending members of Congress to Israel, unquote. So this is the Wall Street Journal. Imagine if Ilhan Omar says that. And she said something, she's just questioning the influence of the Israel lobby, of the AIPAC and the Israel lobby. And then all hell broke loose. And here we have the Wall Street Journal saying that.
Right. No, you're right. I mean, the Wall Street Journal is, they're stating facts. And this is the, unfortunately, the times we're living in, where Ilhan is a Muslim woman and a woman of color is not allowed to speak the truth and is being censored and is being nitpicked every word she says. And Ilhan is fighting the good fight. I mean, she is fighting the good fight, and she is putting herself out there and understands the position she's in, and we're blessed to have her representing us. The fact that AIPAC is spending $100 million just shows you what we as a community are up against, and the influence that they have is real. There's nothing anti-Semitic about saying this. There's nothing anti-Semitic about questioning AIPAC, questioning their role, and questioning the role Israel and the Israeli government plays in driving AIPAC. This is a conversation we need to be having, and it's something that we need to take a close look at.
So I want to ask you, I mean, I know you work on Capitol Hill sometimes, you meet with Congress people and so on, and we're bringing this up because for so many years, I mean, this astonishing relationship with Israel, a foreign country that commits war crimes on an ongoing basis, violates human rights on daily basis. I mean, it continues to occupy land that it doesn't belong to. It's Syrian land, Lebanese land, Palestinian lands. And this relationship is not just, hey, let's just be friends with Israel, but it actually funds and provides Israel with billions of U.S. tax dollars every single year. So why is it a taboo for anyone to question this relationship and the influence the Israel lobby has in the U.S.? I mean, those politicians, sometimes I think they work for the United States of Israel, not the United States of America.
Well, I mean, a lot of it has to go back with Alhan's first statement, which got her a lot of heat. But you do have to take a look at the money that's involved and what influence that plays in these politicians and the decisions they make. Anybody who steps back and takes a look at the relationship between the U.S. and Israel sees that it's not as good and rosy as the impact of it are not as good and rosy as it's made out to be. This relationship has led to a lot of problems. It's led to humanitarian crisis, led to ethnic cleansing, and it's led to an apartheid state. And it needs to stop. And when you're spending, you know, billions of dollars to a foreign country that is an apartheid state, that's treating, you know, Arabs and Muslims as second-class citizens, we have to look at why that money is going there. There's nothing wrong or nothing with bringing that argument to the table and taking a look at these facts, and they speak for themselves. You know, this has been the long game of the Israeli lobby, and they've invested decades into building this relationship and getting us to a point where they are able to attack somebody like Ilhan, or they are able to introduce anti-BDS measures, which are, you know, clearly violate the First Amendment. But many politicians on a local, federal, and state level just sit back with their, you know, hands folded and do nothing about it. That's because they've built themselves up to this level and have put in decades worth of lobbying to get to this point. But, you know, what we have on our side is truth and it's justice, and we have everything right is on our side, and we can overcome that relatively quickly, and we are getting organized. So their decades of work will be overcome very soon, and we are starting to see the cracks in the wall. We are starting to see changes occur. And the fact that even the Democratic Party is having these conversations, having these debates, is a sign that the tide is starting to turn. People are starting to open their eyes. There's a crack in the facade of the Israeli lobby and this relationship between the U.S. and Israel, and it'll keep going and moving at a rapid pace in our favor.
You know, and you talked about Israel claims to be a country for its citizens. We know, because you talked about it discriminates even against its own citizens. 20% of the Israeli population is Palestinian. And Netanyahu, the current prime minister, he just said a few days ago that Israel is a state only for the Jewish people, not for Palestinians, not for Arabs, not for anybody. Even, I'm not talking about the West Bank, the occupied West Bank, the occupied Gaza Strip, and the occupied East Jerusalem. Even Israel, he claims that we don't want the Arabs in it. This is only for Jews, period.
Look, Israel is an apartheid state. I mean, what Netanyahu was saying is the truth. I mean, he's speaking the truth. This is what they are putting Israel forward as. And it is an apartheid state. And right now, you know, it's not for Arabs. It's not for Muslims. They are treated as second-class citizens. And what he's speaking is what he's really feeling. And I know he backtracked, earlier today. But we know how they feel. We know the people he's aligned himself with and the new government he formed. These are the same people he formed a government with that attacked our offices and killed our director on the West Coast in the 1980s, Alex Ode. These are the same people responsible for bombing the ADC office in 1985 and bombing the ADC offices in Boston and in Washington, D.C. as well. So we know firsthand what they're capable of doing. And the Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza also know firsthand of what these radicals and extremists are capable of doing and the harm they're capable of inflicting.
And the United Nations released a report, I believe it was last week, saying that Israel may have committed war crimes in Gaza over the past several months with the protests inside the Gaza Strip towards the occupation, towards the Israeli atrocities. And here we go, the United Nations Commission, I believe, for Human Rights, saying, hey, Israel is committing war crimes in Gaza. Question is, nobody seems to be listening there, because there is we believe it was a Democrat in Congress who a Democratic congressman who suggested very recently that Israel can go back to the first century borders, even take Lebanon, Syria, you name it. I mean, a United States congressman say, even Israel probably not saying that, at least not publicly.
Look, I mean, this is this is how many of them feel, and this is what we're up against, and this is the mindset we're up against. So we know how outrageous that statement is, but we need to, as a community, as an Arab community, a Muslim community, as a peace-loving community, we need to come together and begin, you know, countering these efforts as we have been doing. We need more voices at the table like Ilhan. We need more people in Congress like Rashida. So this is how this is going to change on that front, through politics, you know, the policy front and the politic front. Then you have on the advocacy side to counter these voices. We need the BDS movement. We need to support BDS. We need to be engaged in BDS. We need to fight the ADC. We'll continue fighting these anti-BDS laws. But this is what we as a community can be doing. You could support your politicians and those in an office, but you know, every one of us can take a role in addressing this, you know, horrible situation.
And that's a very good point that you bring up, of course, that people need to rally, people need to act, people need to respond, to do. And we know with what happened with Ilhan, many, numerous organizations and individuals, including prominent Jewish Americans and Jewish organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, they published comments in support of Ilhan Omar. Thousands of activists mobilized in support of her. And that's what made House Democrats, you know, they were going to force... they were going to issue a resolution to condemn Ilhan Omar, but they ended up rewriting that resolution meant to condemn Ilhan Omar for the statements she had made challenging the Israel lobby, falsely represented as anti-Semitic and so on. And they ended up passing a resolution last Thursday that actually condemned anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim discrimination, white supremacy, and other forms of hate. That passed overwhelmingly, 407-23, with about 24 Republicans voting against it. Your reaction to that, what some people call historic and important resolution?
Look, our position is this. The resolution should not have been introduced in the first place. The framework of the resolution, the fact that it was introduced in response to Ilhan speaking the truth, is problematic. So there should not have been a resolution to begin with. The fact the anti-Semitism language, the reason the anti-Semitism language is in there is directly related to Ilhan's comments. So yes, you know, we are glad that the Muslim language is included, the language against Islamophobia, against hate in general is included. But let's not lose sight of the fact that it was Democratic leadership that put themselves in this position and introduced this resolution when they should not have. They should not have done that, should not have taken this step. They did themselves a favor by listening to the outrage, listening to the progressives within the Democratic Party, and adding that extra language. But we need to keep this in the memory bank. We need to remember, you know, what Nancy Pelosi and what the leadership did in the position they put Ilhan in. And they could have taken a different route from the beginning, but they did the best of it. They did include that language, and we are thankful they did that. But the framework around the resolution remains problematic itself.
And I want to talk about the media in the United States. Several media outlets, especially Fox News, at least to me, have this unbelievable attack and bigotry against Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, that goes really very, very long time over the years. And some even attribute the rise in hate crimes against Arabs and Muslims in the U.S. and the rise in attacks against Arabs and Muslims in the U.S. to those media outlets that feed this hateful information and the fear-mongering amongst people who live in the United States. Recently, Jeanine Pirro, the judge who has her own show on Fox News, she basically describes Ilhan Omar wearing the hijab that is against the Constitution. And, of course, the famous quote-unquote famous, Tucker Carlson of Fox News. He apparently, an audio surfaced of a previous radio interview, I believe it was, of him saying an unbelievable words against Arab culture and against Iraqis. I don't even want to repeat the words on the show. Yeah. I have the audio, nor do I want to play it. I'll be bleeping every other word that he would say. I mean, those are astonishing. Yeah. If somebody else says that, you would think he would be fired already a long time ago.
Yeah, the rhetoric against Arabs and Muslims has been, there's been rhetoric against us for decades now, but it's more in the open. And somebody like Tucker Carlson, you know, should not have a platform to push this hatred, push this bigotry, and the only thing Fox News can do is condemn him. He should be taken off the air. With Fox News not keeping him on the air, basically what they're doing, what they're saying, is we stand by these comments and we stand by Tucker Carlson and his views. We're not surprised. I mean, this is what Fox News is. This is what they placate to, and these are the people they're trying to reach, are the ones that share his views. They're the ones that are look at us as the other. They look at Arabs, they look at Muslims and the black community, the brown community, and they don't like us. To put in simple words, they don't like us. They think we're uncivilized. And unfortunately, he has a platform. If you take his comments and remove the word Arab or Iraqi and include, scratch that out and say, Catholics or Jews, the response from Fox News would be quicker. But unfortunately now, the response from Fox News would be stronger. But unfortunately now, you have a green light when you to go against our community, to go after our community, to speak like that about our community, because it's coming from the top. It's coming from President Trump and leadership. You know, when he calls, African countries us whole countries, or when he implements a Muslim ban that bans, our people from coming in, he's given a green light, and it's a dog whistle to the bigots to be able to speak this way, and that's what Tucker Carlson is doing.
How about the United States foreign policy? Obviously matters a lot, but we have seen a policy over the years, not just under the Trump administration, that has been fully blindly supporting Israel no matter what, no matter what it does. Every administration is different to some extent, but they all seem to agree on one thing: you have to support Israel no matter what. Under the Trump administration, major events took place when the U.S. recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, when they moved the embassy to Jerusalem, they closed the PLO office mission in Washington. And recently, I believe it was either today or yesterday, when they released their annual human rights report, the Trump administration replaced the words occupied with Israeli controlled, talking about the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, in its annual human rights report. And it also dropped reference to the Syrian Golan Heights, which is occupied by Israel, as being occupied. They dropped occupied from it. And this is the second year in a row the Trump administration removes the words occupied and occupation from its reports.
Yes. Well, look, we know the direction the Trump organization, the Trump administration is going. I mean, the first thing, one of his first moves was moving the embassy to Jerusalem. And he's had a really placating to Netanyahu's wishes. And whatever he puts down in those reports and those papers, we know the reality on the ground. It's our job to counter that. This administration, on a number of issues, just is doing their own thing. And this is just another example of them not really looking at what impact their actions have. But the report is problematic. The framing is problematic, and we have to counter that. This guy Trump is really has some crazy views out that we have to be careful. But his lasting legacy will be changing the dynamics of the Israeli situation and the Palestinian situation, in the fact that he's made it a GOP GOP supports Israel. He's allowed the Democrats and given them cover to come out the way they did when somebody attacked Ilhan. So we're going to see more and more of this, and it's a direct result of Trump and what people think of Trump. The only thing is that if the next administration comes in, and if it does come from the Democratic Party, we have to watch carefully. Will they continue the Trump policy? Will they re-add the word occupied? Will they remove the embassy? Part of me feels that they may not do so, and if that's the case, we need to let the Democratic Party know how we feel. So we can't feel comfortable in one party or another. I still have my concerns and my doubts about the next administration, whether, you know, if it is a Democratic administration comes in, that they would reverse anything that Trump has done. He's going to leave a legacy on what's happening in Israel and Palestine, and it, you know, that through time will tell you know, the impact of it.
The website again is adc.org. Abid Ayyub, National Legal and Policy Director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, was joining us live from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much, Abid. We greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, Executive Producer and Host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
Last month marked the 10th anniversary of Israel's illegal, massive, deadly attack on the Palestinian people living in the open-air prison of the Gaza Strip along the Mediterranean Sea in the south of Israel-Palestine. The attack was carried out with the political and military support of the George W. Bush regime during its final few days. Some 1,200 Palestinians were killed, including 500 children. This has been documented in the United Nations-sponsored Goldstone Report. Israel's continuing illegal settlement of Palestinian land and its dispossession of Palestinian people is made possible by American political, military, and economic support. But this support is coming under increasing challenge with Israel's violation of human rights and of international law being more and more widely exposed and discussed. Here to speak with us today from Washington, D.C. is Helena Coban. She is the president of the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit Just World Educational. She's had a 45-year career of analyzing and writing about the Palestine question and other international issues. She has traveled to Gaza numerous times and has interviewed leaders and activists in all the major Palestinian resistance organizations, for her own books and for other platforms. Helena Coban, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be with you.
Since we'll be discussing today the events of Israel's full-blown military assault on the Gaza Strip back in 2008, and of course there have been two subsequent ones, one of them even more deadly, called Operation Cast Lead, can you outline where the Gaza Strip is located, what its population is, where they came from, and something about its economic circumstances and governance?
Well, good. Yep, sure. The Gaza Strip is located at the bottom right-hand corner of the Mediterranean, going up a little bit sort of into Israel. So its borders on the north and east side are controlled by Israel, and the short border on the south side is controlled by Egypt. The population of Gaza is currently about 2 million people. The vast majority of them are civilians, and more than 70% of them are registered Palestinian refugees from the war of 1948, when they were expelled and fled from areas that became Israel in that year and have been forbidden by Israel from returning to those homes for the subsequent 71 years. So these are 71-year-old Palestinian communities. Many of the, obviously, the original refugees have died, and all of them have had, well, nearly all of them have had children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and still their internationally recognized right to return to their homes and properties has been denied.
After the 1967 war, when Israel occupied Gaza, Israel built a number of Jewish agricultural settlements there, and then it subsequently dismantled them. Since that time, Israel has assaulted the Gaza Strip on three different occasions.
each of which involved the loss of large numbers of Palestinian lives. One of those was the invasion by land and sea that lasted 3 weeks that Israel called Operation Cast Lead. And this, of course, is the 10th anniversary of that slaughter. Can you describe the Israeli reason for the invasion and the results?
Sure. Well, you know, the Israelis gave a public reason, which was to prevent the smuggling by the people in Gaza of things in and out of the Gaza Strip by tunnels. So you have to understand that when Israel pulled its settlers and soldiers out of the heart of Gaza in 2005, actually George W. Bush and Condoleezza Rice brokered an agreement that assured the free access and movement of Palestinians between Gaza and the West Bank, which is over on the other side of some Israeli-held territory, and other means of access and movement for them. But then in 2006, the Palestinians held a legislative election that was free and fair and deemed to be free and fair by the Carter Center and other experienced election monitors, and Hamas won that election. At that point, the Israelis just tore up the agreement on movement and access and started imposing a brutal siege around Gaza. So it's been besieged essentially since the middle of 2006, that is for the past almost 13 years. And so people in Gaza, to get things in and out, and generally this is commodities, you know, diapers, cookies, cooking oil, whatever, have had, you know, an extensive system of tunnels along that short border with Egypt. There were also some arms that were smuggled in through the tunnels because, you know, the occupied Palestinians in Gaza, like people under military occupation anywhere in the world, have an internationally recognized right to resist their occupiers. And it's important to note that although the Israelis pulled their settlers and troops from the heart of Gaza in 2005, the fact that they continued very, very intensely to control the borders, airspace, sea access, all access to Gaza, means that the international community, everybody in the international community, including our government, continues to consider that Gaza is occupied in a military way by Israel. So the Palestinians have the right to resist that occupation and to win their liberation, and they have on occasion used military means to do so, including sending rockets and mortars. They have very, very primitive, I call them bottle rockets. They're a little bit better than a bottle rocket, but not that much better, bigger, more powerful. But especially when the Israelis launch one of their, like, they've had many big incursions, as you noted, but they've also launched a lot of little attacks, constant little attacks, including the Israelis will shoot at any Gaza farmer who approaches closer than half a kilometer to that fence, that armistice line fence. So, and the Israelis, you know, send snatch squads in to snatch or kill people that they want to kill whenever they want to. So in the view of many in the international community, including my friend and colleague, Professor Richard Falk, Gaza is like an open-air prison. So that is what it's like to live there for these 2 million people, the vast majority of whom are civilians. That's the kind of the background to each of these three massive assaults, which you could describe more like being a riot by unbelievably well-armed corrections officers against the inmates than a regular war, because the people inside Gaza have almost no means of defense and certainly nothing capable of standing up to or countering the very high-tech, very destructive, and usually U.S.-supplied weapons that Israel has used to wage war against them. That's why you end up with these really tragic casualty figures in the Carst-led assault back 10 years ago, 1,417 Palestinians were killed by the Israelis, the vast majority of them civilians, because it's a very heavily populated, densely populated place. And on the other side, on the Israeli side, 10 Israeli soldiers and 3 Israeli civilians lost their lives. Well, 4 of the soldiers were killed by their own side. So the casualties inflicted by the Palestinians were 6 Israeli soldiers and 3 Israeli civilians, which each of those losses is tragic, but each of the 1,417 Palestinian lives lost is also tragic. So, you know, there's this just gross asymmetry between the two groups.
What weapons did the Israelis use, and are any of these weapons banned by the laws of war?
Well, I think white phosphorus is the main one that was seen. White phosphorus is supposed to be used only for illumination, because it, you know, it lights up an area, especially at nighttime or in bad lighting conditions. But it is extremely damaging when it falls on people or things. It sticks to them and burns very hot and very deep, and it's hard to get off. So there are definitely many documented instances of the Israelis dropping white phosphorus. They look, when you see those photos, they are strangely beautiful. But then you look at the photos of the kids and people in the streets on whom it fell, and it's just a disaster. So that's the main weapon system. And actually, after Carst-led, they didn't use it in 2 subsequent ones because the international outcry was so huge. But beyond the weapon systems as such, you have to look at the tactics and means of fighting. So international law is very clear on how weapons should be used in war. And the two of the key principles here are that you have to, a fighting force should be at great pains to discriminate between legitimate military targets and illegitimate, largely civilian targets. And that clearly did not happen, because if you look at the casualty toll, including on that first day in Carst-led, they targeted a civilian police academy, which is not a legitimate target. There are many other instances of illegitimate targets that they targeted. And of course, they did not discriminate enough between legitimate and illegitimate targets. And the other key principle is proportionality. And that's a fuzzier concept in international law, but you have to keep your response proportional to the threat that you face. And the Israelis had, you know, a few civilian wounded people, three civilian deaths, and a very little bit of physical damage from the Hamas rockets. So their response was in no way proportional. If you look at the devastation of Gaza, I actually went to Gaza shortly thereafter, and it was worse than Dresden or Coventry or any of these sites that were massively bombed during World War II. An additional thing in Gaza is that Israel is considered to be the occupying power, and an occupying power has a specific additional responsibility for the well-being, I would say even the flourishing, of the lives of the people in territory occupied. Now, of course, military occupation is only ever supposed to be a transitional thing, a transitional status en route to a final peace, something that the Palestinians have not been able to win since 1967. So they've been under military occupation for more than 50 years there in Gaza. And Israel absolutely has not paid any attention to its responsibility for the well-being of the 2 million people of Gaza.
During the invasion and its aftermath, there was a huge international outcry at the disproportionate loss of Palestinian life and the casualties. that were caused by the Israelis, and the destruction of the Palestinian infrastructure, sewage treatment plants, water plants, schools, food processing, all these facilities were destroyed. Can you expand upon what the international outcry was?
Oh, yes. It was. It started even on January 21st, 10 years ago, in 2009, when the Undersecretary General of the United Nations for Humanitarian Affairs, John Holmes, was able to visit Gaza. And he was shocked. He said something like, you know, shocked to see the extent to which the civilian infrastructure and the industrial sector had been targeted and nearly completely destroyed. And I saw that when I went there, I would say in March of 2009. We drove up and down the eastern border of Gaza, and just mile upon mile of destroyed manufacturing facilities, food processing facilities, as you mentioned, water treatment. And you know, there were statements during the war in which Israeli military leaders, I think including the commander of the Southern Command, said, we want to send Gaza back decades. And of course that's completely illegitimate under the international laws of war, because they were targeting civilian infrastructure, including industrial and vital utilities. So, yeah, there was an outcry, a huge outcry, by governments and by civil society around the world. So we saw, for example, the international solidarity movement sent people to visit Gaza. We saw the birth of the flotilla movement, where people were trying to break the siege of Gaza by sea. And a couple of those ships, the early ships, flotillas, got through, but I think after Carsled, none of them got through. This siege is really, really damaging. I can't express in words how damaging it is for the people of Gaza. It is like being in a prison when you can get there, and it's very hard for us as outsiders to get there. And, of course, when I saw that destruction, you know, Gaza used to be a very busy manufacturing place. It's got a highly educated population, many of them refugees, reliant on, you know, wage labor, and so there used to be a lot of furnishing facilities, you know, places where they made furniture, places where they did food processing, all kinds of light industry. And nearly all that was bombed by the Israelis in 2008, 2009. It was terrible. It sent them ways back. And as a result, Gaza is now almost wholly reliant on international handouts.
Yeah, which are being cut back.
Yeah. and then, of course, you know, Trump cuts back the funding. So... that is terrible, but luckily there are other donors to the United Nations Relief and Work Agency in Gaza.
Well, the Israelis have proclaimed they're going to put the people in Gaza on a diet and try to control the amount of calories they consume. But I wanted to go to the Goldstone Report, Helena. The Goldstone Report was issued under the auspices of the United Nations, and it cataloged what happened to the people of Gaza and its violations of international law. And I wanted to ask you about it. Who was Goldstone? I know you've met him. What was the U.S. response to the Goldstone report? What happened to the report? What happened to Goldstone?
So, yes, Judge Richard Goldstone had been a commercial judge in South Africa in the days of apartheid, and he played a minor role as the head of an investigation commission in those days, and then he thereby came to the attention of the international community, and he became the first chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, which was formed in the early 90s, and then also of Rwanda. I met and interviewed him a couple of times in the early aughts when he was still in The Hague. So he was, by that time, a sort of a distinguished international jurist, although his specialty had never traditionally been international law or international humanitarian law, the laws of war. So the UN voted in, you know, late January 2009, amidst this horror at what had happened in Gaza, to create a fact-finding commission, and it was headed by Goldstone. There were three other distinguished international jurists, all of whom did actually have a background in international humanitarian law and international law. Christine Chinkin, Hina Silani, somebody else. So it was a four-member commission, and they had to report back with recommendations to the Security Council in the form of a report, which they presented, I believe, in September of 2009. And it was called the Goldstone Report, and it accused both the Israel Defense Forces and Palestinian militants of war crimes and possible crimes against humanity. So it did so on the basis that in the case of the Palestinian militants, as I mentioned, they had, you know, only this very primitive weaponry, which does not have precision guidance capabilities. So if you look at the casualties on the Israeli side, the fact that the Palestinians killed six Israeli soldiers and three Israeli civilians indicates to me that there was no particular targeting of civilians, but rather a very close targeting of soldiers. And I think most of those soldiers died near the border, near the armistice line. So maybe there's a case to be made that they did not sufficiently, you know, guide and target their rockets, in which case, obviously, give them precision-guided missile systems such as the U.S. and Israel and all, you know, super modern militaries have. But on the Israeli side, you know, as I think I outlined earlier, that they did not discriminate enough between legitimate military targets and non-combatant sites. So when the Goldstone report was presented and found that both sides had probably committed war crimes and possible crimes against humanity, on the behalf of Israel and its supporters, there was an outcry. I mean, how could this judge possibly consider that, possibly accuse Israel of having created, having committed war crimes and possible crimes against humanity? So what the Security Council had actually said is that the Goldstone Commission will make its report, and the report recommended that both sides investigate their own military and bring to account anybody who had committed these violations, and that if that didn't happen, then the Security Council should refer the case to the International Criminal Court, which the Security Council can do, but it has to allow each side to make its own investigation first. Long story short, on the Israeli side, there were, on neither side was there ever anything like a thorough investigation and holding to account of the military leaders. But specifically on the Israeli side, you know, there were some very well-documented cases. There was the case of the Samouni family whose rights were violated in a terrible way. I think 21 of them were killed. There was the case of the Israeli military having dropped white phosphorus onto a UN school that was being used as a shelter for the displaced, and other attacks on clearly designated UN shelters. And none of this was ever investigated by the Israelis. In fact, just in December, just, you know, very recently, December of 2018, an Israeli military court or Israeli court that had been investigating one of these more famous cases, the case of the four girls from Dr. Abu Aisha's family who were killed by an Israeli bomb. The judge in Israel found that there was no criminal responsibility by the pilot who had dropped the bomb. So that was the end. You know, there has never been any accountability. And, of course, the Security Council has never been able to refer the case to the International Criminal Court because the U.S. nearly always, with very, very few exceptions, protects Israel at the Security Council. Judge Goldstone was unfortunately persuaded by people in his family and his synagogue to take his name off the report. And I should also note that in the lead up to that, the Obama administration and his Undersecretary of State for Human Rights, Michael Posner, actually helped the Israelis to fight against the Goldstone report, which they had described as a poisonous report. So this issue of the United States shielding Israel is constant throughout Operation Cast Lead 10 years ago, throughout the Obama administration, and until today.
We're speaking with Helena Coban from Just World Educational. Please share with our listeners how they can contact your organization.
Well, thanks for asking, Michael. Yep. Our website is www.justworldeducational.org, and we have a pretty strong presence on Facebook and Twitter. We have just been wrapping up our project for the 10th anniversary of Operation Cast Lead, but we are coming up to another very important Gaza-related project that we're doing, because I hope your listeners are familiar with this movement, this amazing, nonviolent, creative movement in Gaza called the Great March of Return. And that movement was launched on March 30th of last year, so we'll be planning something big in the lead up to the first anniversary on March 30th of this year. We have a lot of other things that we do. We do a lot of anti-militarism work, but we certainly do a lot on the Palestinian rights issue.
Helena Coban from Just World Educational, thank you very much for being our guest on Law and Disorder, and keep up your good work. You take it easy.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's always good talking to you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the world premiere of Jump, co-produced by Confrontation Theater and the Milagro Theater. The play runs from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro